Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to this week's episode of Firefly Willows LIVE Presents. Join us as we revolutionize the spirit of the season on Revolution with High C. Journey with us from the mundane level of giving gifts to the spiritual plane of making offerings. And enjoy our new monthly feature with astrologer James Moran. He'll be offering an astrological outlook to help us best access and utilize the celestial energies at play. High C's featured guest is Yeshe Rabbit, co-owner of the Sacred Well in Oakland, California, and presiding high priestess of Come As You Are Coven, an eclectic pagan community in the Bay Area. Rabbit will be offering us a meditation and practice for making offerings that may serve you in your evolution and in manifesting not only what you want in life, but also in who you want to become. Plus, meet High C's new co-host, Charlie, as we give you a sneak peek of our new show, Amethyst Oracle, Divination with a Queer Twist, debuting Tuesday, December 11th. Call in and receive a reading during the latter part of the show at 646-716-5510. The LIVE Roundtable is an opportunity for all of our hosts to come together and share their thoughts, experience, and insights on a variety of topics that are of particular interest to each of them. Today's moderator is Heisey Ludmers, and our roundtable topic is, how can we allow ourselves to better receive compassion?
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the show. Thanks for listening today. And I think we have a very interesting show lined up. One of the things I'm very excited about is in the latter portion of the show, introducing you to my new co-host, Charlie, who will be joining me for a new program that we're doing underneath the Firefly Willows Live channel called the Amethyst Oracle. And that's actually just the first show in a number of shows that are going to be debuting in the new year. So we hope that you will keep listening and find out more information about those, as well as at the end of the month of December, we're going to have a special show that's going to introduce you to a number of the co-hosts, as well as the different shows that are going to be coming up under the Firefly Willows Live channel in 2013. But for our show today, we have a number of things to look forward to. We're going to be having our roundtable discussion, and joining me for that are our other co-hosts of Firefly Willows Live, Mildred Lynn McDonald. Hello, Mildred.
Good morning. Hi, C.
And John Caracella and Deb Caracella.
Good morning, Hi, C.
Hi, guys.
Hello. And then a little later in the show, we have a new segment that I'm adding to this show, which is our little astrology outlook for the month that will be offered to us from James Moran, who is an astrologer in the San Francisco Bay Area, as well as my conversation regarding the subject of offerings with Yeshe Rabbit. So we will be getting to those segments a little later, but for right now, we're going to start our roundtable topic and discussion. And the topic I'd like to bring up today is one about compassion. And we hear a lot about compassion, but generally what we hear about is how to be more compassionate toward others, how we can extend compassion, how we can cultivate compassion towards other people. But a lot of times what we don't hear much about is how do we receive compassion? How do we cultivate the ability to be open and receptive to compassion when someone else is wanting to extend that compassion towards us? And we often have difficulty in receiving that kind of thing from other people. So there's a number of ways that I'd like to approach this. And the first way is I'm going to ask my fellow co-hosts, as well as I'd like anyone listening to think about this for themselves. How have you experienced receiving compassion, and what has that felt like when you have been on the receiving end of that?
Well, Mildred. One of the things that I did in getting prepared to talk about this topic with you guys this morning was I actually went and looked up the definition of the words compassion and pity. And I discovered that the meanings of the word compassion and pity are actually very, very similar. It's only been in very recent times that the word pity has taken on a connotation of negativity, that there is a sense of the individual who is receiving the feelings of compassion and empathy are somehow inferior to the person who is expressing the feelings. And that is not how pity was originally defined or even felt or understood by people. So I think part of the problem that we have today and the reason that it's so difficult for individuals to accept compassion from another is that it is so closely entwined with the sense of, well, maybe they're just pitying me. And that besides being opening ourselves and being vulnerable and realizing that our circumstances have placed us in a position where we could use the assistance or the feelings and compassion of others, we have become vulnerable. We're now not only vulnerable, but we're fighting with the feeling that perhaps we're being seen as inferior as well, that maybe the feelings that are being expressed towards us have some pity involved in them. And so it's even harder for us to be open and available and just allow ourselves to accept the empathy of another, someone who understands the situation that we have, that we find ourselves in, and just accept that there's another human being out there that understands and feels for us and wants to do something to alleviate that situation or at least to share in it with us.
And I think maybe tied into that, sometimes people also maybe equate compassion with sympathy, the same that you're talking about with pity.
Yes.
But with either of those, compassion has no bias or judgment as part of it. And with pity or with sympathy, a lot of times you hear phrases like, oh, that's too bad, or something like that. And there's kind of an implied bias or judgment, and it isn't necessarily a judgment towards the other person. It may just be, oh, I'm glad that's not happening to me. But compassion doesn't say that, because compassion actually would say, I would be perfectly fine experiencing that if it would help to alleviate the suffering of this other person in some way. And I think that people, one, when they feel that they're being pitied, they often feel that there is at least an implied judgment in there somewhere or criticism in some way, but also that we get into the area of worthiness. And I think a lot of people don't feel worthy of receiving that kind of compassion from another.
Yes, I would agree with that.
Mildred, did you have something to say?
Sure. I think what you had asked, at least what I remember, is, if I've received compassion, and how did that make me feel?
Yes.
Yeah. So usually if I receive a kindness or compassion from others, my first reaction is surprise. I'm usually surprised. And then I move immediately into being thankful, refreshed, and as a form of relief. And then the next part is kind of funny, because I feel that, well, this was easy. This is how it should be. Mm-hmm. The other part that I was exploring a little bit is, when we receive compassion, what do we choose to make it mean? Do we make it mean that we're vulnerable? Do we make it mean that we're not worthy? Do we make it mean that we're weak? And it occurred to me, and I relate to myself with this, is if we choose to explore the meaning of how we feel when we are offered compassion and shift that to a higher vibration, that might be a worthy exercise, at least something worthy of exploring.
And I think something you said right at the beginning, and I'm going to ask you a question, is why does it surprise you that someone would be compassionate towards you?
It surprises me because I'm usually in the giving mode. So I'm pretty focused on giving, and when someone actually gives to me, it just takes me by, it makes me stop in my tracks.
And I think that's very common for a lot of people, because we're, like I was saying at the beginning, I think we hear so much about how we need to cultivate compassion and be compassionate towards others, that we tend to be very focused on how do I give more? How do I be more compassionate towards? And I would actually venture to say that if we don't allow ourselves the opportunity to experience receiving compassion and know what that feels like, then we may never be able to fully extend compassion to another, because it's hard to fully give something if you haven't experienced what it is like to receive it in the first place.
I think that's very true, Heisi. I think one of the things that is running around in my mind right now is the practice of receiving, exercising the capacity to receive, and exercising an awareness of the opportunities to receive compassion. You know, we're so busy being independent, excuse me, being self-sufficient, being independent, being strong. Our culture rewards that so much, and it really doesn't incline us to look for opportunities where we can receive compassion. And you know, this scales down to the mundane, where we often don't actively look for the opportunities to receive assistance. And compassion is so much more, is so much deeper and more intimate thing to receive, and requires us to be so much more open than simply receiving help, that I think our idea of self-sufficiency is tightly coupled to the our idea of not being vulnerable, and our idea of being and doing the right things for ourselves and our lives, that we don't ever actively exercise the capacity to notice when compassion is available and can be there to nurture us. Because we're wired in the absolute opposite direction.
And I think that that ties into another word that I would associate with compassion, which is being witnessed. If we're going to receive compassion, it means that there is another who is witnessing us, who is seeing us in our state of humanness or humanity. And something that Mildred talked about, something you were talking about, John, is that, one, our society is much more focused on rewarding witnessing people when they succeed or accomplish something.
Right.
But it also then it kind of cultivates within people a sense of embarrassment or shame if they're being witnessed or seen when they're in a state of weakness or need or vulnerability. And so it's as if we're kind of trained to not show our human side, but only our accomplishment, successful side, and otherwise hide the when we're not that, rather than being open to receiving what someone else may be able to offer or give us when we're in need of that.
There's one other area I see that could potentially impact that, and it's in the realm of owing a person that helped you, somehow feeling indebted to a person that may have shown you compassion. So it might be, well, you did this for me, and now I owe you. So some people might not be comfortable in that mindset. It's not necessary if you truly give. You're not expecting a reward. That could be a place, though, that some people might be trained to come from.
I think you're right, Mildred Lynn. I think there is a correlation, and you know, when you don't experience compassion very often, which many of us don't, because we're not attuned to it being offered, I think we do think of it as an exchange, and when we receive help, we often think, well, okay, that person helped me, I owe them something. But when we experience compassion, when we receive compassion, there really it's funny for me. There isn't a tally sheet in heaven. You know, it isn't like that. I've discovered that it really is, as you say, it's a kind of a liberating feeling, and I become free to offer compassion to others, and it doesn't feel like I'm working off a debt. It feels like I'm participating in abundance.
Yeah, and, you know, compassion has no obligation for, like, the back and forth, in a sense, because for me, compassion is simply the recognition of the humanity in another, and that they are also living the human experience just the same way that I am. Therefore, when I have the opportunity to extend compassion, I am recognizing that. But when I have the opportunity to receive compassion, it means someone else is simply seeing me as a fellow human being. And, you know, when you do that, you don't feel that obligation of having to return it in some way. You simply feel a lot of what you've been talking about, which is joy or gratitude or abundance. It just has a different feeling. But especially in this time of year, because it's, you know, we think so much about, well, so and so gave me a gift, therefore, what am I going to get them? I better get them something since they gave me something and I feel obligated to return that. And with compassion, there just is not any sort of underlying aspect or energy to obligation. But that I think, because one of the big questions that I would have is what gets in the way the most of people being able to not only receive compassion, but recognize when compassion is being extended or offered to them. And I think, Mildred, you've touched on that, which is that feeling of obligation. But I would ask if there's anything else that any of you feel is one of the biggest obstacles or stumbling blocks for people to be able to both recognize when compassion is being extended towards them, as well as to them being able to receive compassion openly and gratefully.
Well, I think that, Heise, you also mentioned earlier in the conversation a feeling of being worthy. And I think that is some part of it, that it's difficult for people to feel that they deserve the extension of compassion from someone else sometimes. Maybe because it's so linked with this sense of being inferior or being vulnerable, or if circumstances have presented themselves in such a way that you were at fault for finding yourself in these circumstances. So as well as the sense of not wanting to owe someone something, am I worthy of this?
And an admission of being in a circumstance that inspires someone to offer me compassion. You know, it's like, am I really this down and out that people are looking at me with pity, right? You know,
right.
And I think that is a challenge. I think another thing that strikes me is a willingness to be tender. You know, we don't use tenderness except as a word, really, except in the movies. You know, but tenderness is a very real capacity to experience, both as a giver and a receiver. You know, if you're tending to, if you are caring for example, a dog that, you know, a rescue dog, a rescue animal, so, you know, some animal that's been abused, it really, there's a real tenderness that's called for there, you know, and we're not used to offering that to one another. We're certainly not used to offering that to strangers, and we're not used to receiving it from one another, and we're certainly not used to receiving it from strangers. So I think that's something that gets in the way, is our capacity to experience tenderness and incorporate it in our daily routine, so to speak.
And so to kind of bring this conversation to a close, I'd like to ask each of you if you can offer maybe one suggestion to people as to how they can better open themselves to and allow themselves to receive compassion and recognize when compassion is being offered to them.
Well, I think maybe moving away from judgment. Don't if someone is offering you assistance, someone is offering you compassion or empathy, just accept. Don't judge. Don't make all kinds of, don't have the little tally sheet. Don't say, okay, is there something they want out of this? Am I going to owe someone something because of this? Simply be grateful that there is another human being who sees where you are and extends the hand and just allow.
My suggestion is really simple. It's to learn how to say thank you and let it go at that. And to observe any feelings that come up after saying that thank you and understand that that's a wonderful opportunity to explore yourself and also to get in touch with your feelings, because if that space is filled with non-life supporting energy after you say thank you or you feel awkward, it's probably a sign that you're not in touch with yourself or your own feelings. And when the person is offering compassion, you're being mirrored back some energy that you have an opportunity to work with or play with. So I've had to learn just to say thank you, and it's been a wonderful exercise, deceptively simple, but a wonderful exercise.
And I guess I would say maybe two things. One is, Deb said it too, kind of don't judge, don't be in judgment. There's a corollary to that for me, which is acknowledge that that your perception of reality might not be the only one. And while you may feel like you don't need it, maybe you do. You know, maybe your perspective on what's happening in your life actually calls for compassion from others, and see if you can see why they're offering it to you in a way that's genuine and without ulterior motives. And the other way to sort of practice is really, we can practice on our pets. You know, when a dog jumps into your lap or a cat rubs against your legs, see it as an act of compassion that they are offering you, especially if you've had a bad day and they're doing it, right? Because really, that's, they don't have any ulterior motive. They just want to share love.
Yeah, and a lot of what all of you have said are things that I was also going to mention. You know, with Deb, I think it really goes to not falling into self-judgment. I don't think people are judging the other person so much for showing them compassion as we fall into that self-judgment mode of, am I worthy of this? Am I being pitied? And remembering, learning how to simply say thank you and receive something rather than thank you, what can I do for you, is a big thing. So Mildred's suggestion of cultivating gratitude and the ability to say thank you without the need to follow it up with, how do I give something back? And like John was saying, as it's a practice, it means it's something that we have to cultivate. We aren't going to just become this or be able to do this overnight. But if we use small opportunities like with pets, et cetera, to practice or cultivate doing this, then we become more adept at it and more comfortable doing it, and then are able to do it without having to think so hard about it. And so... To close, I just wanted to read a little quote, and this is from a blog post that I saw about compassion. The blog is called The Hermit's Lamp, and the quote says, "Compassion is one of the most life-affirming states you can experience. It allows us to value life as the astounding miracle that it is." And I think that's what we have the opportunity to experience, not only when we show compassion towards others, but allow ourselves to receive it, is we get to be part of that experience of what the miracle of life is. And it helps us to feel reaffirmed as a human because someone else is witnessing, noticing, and acknowledging our humanity amidst all of the other humans that we are on this planet with. So I'd like to say thank you to everyone here for having participated in the conversation. Thank you to Mildred and to John and to Deb.
Thanks, Betsy. This is great.
And I would encourage everyone that's listening to simply take some time to think for themselves. Do you allow yourself to receive compassion? How can you better be open to and allow that? And what are the things that tend to get in the way for you, and how can you start to overcome those, whether it's a lack of feeling worthy, falling into self-judgment, etc., but how can you work to overcome those so that you can better receive and experience compassion? So thank you, everyone, for joining in this conversation. And as we move forward in the show, we're going to move into the new segment of astrology. And James Moran is going to give us a little bit of insight into what's happening up there in the stars, how it's affecting us, and what we can kind of anticipate energetically over the next month so that we can know better how to work with that and adjust to that when we feel things are a little bit challenging. If we know why, then we can adapt. So stay tuned for that, and hopefully you'll enjoy that. And then coming up right after that, we will be having my conversation with Yeshe Rabbit from the San Francisco Bay Area.
Hello, dear listeners. This is your astrology update with James Moran. And it is the update for December 2012. And in order to do the update for December, I'd like to recap a bit on what has been happening astrologically over November. So we have actually in October, November, Saturn entering into Scorpio. And this we could see in the news as Saturn being the truth and the reality check, Scorpio being the sign of the hidden, the taboo. We saw it in the news with Lance Armstrong and his Tour de France, the truth about his Tour de France wins. We saw it in the Petraeus scandal that was very scorpionic in its taboo, muddled mire. Also, we had Venus enter into Scorpio in November, and when Venus entered into Scorpio, it went conjunct with Saturn, so that when Venus conjoins with Saturn, that same truth principle comes out in the realm of love, and again, it can have a scorpionic hue to it, the truth about love that the Saturn could be limiting of love if we look at Venus as the archetype of love, harmony, beauty, also artistic harmony and expression. Saturn limiting that, kind of revealing the true limitations of that, but also there can be beauty in that limitation and groundedness. Mars in mid-November entered into the Uranus-Pluto square in the sky. So the Uranus-Pluto square, which is the big news not only of this year and previous years and next year, but the big news of the entire decade. Uranus is the rebel, the impulse towards freedom and disruption, the sudden, the exciting. Pluto is the powers that lie beneath, the alchemical transformative powers within that compel us, like instinctual drives come from beneath the surface within us and compel us to act. And in this combination, the action is towards liberation, Uranus. When those planets came into hard aspect for the first time, coming into a strong aspect since the 60s, we saw the Arab Spring, we saw the Occupy movement. Now those planets, they've remained in this square since around 2008 when it began. But most of the end of this year, they've both been retrograde. Now they're both moving forward. As of mid-December, they're both moving forward. So we'll kind of see that revolutionary impulse, that deep impelled, compelled, and liberated impulse towards transformation, turning things over, the death of the old, the rebirth of the new. We'll see how that pans out moving forward into the new year as they move towards a conjunction, an exact 90-degree conjunction in May. There's several times when they go exact up until 2015, and the next one is May of 2013. So that's a very potent combination in the sky, and in mid-November, Mars began to enter into that combination with a, we could say, a wide orb, because Mars likes to leap into action first thing. So as soon as it begins to come close to that square, it begins to become active, and so we see Mars beginning to conjoin with Pluto and square Uranus. Mars being the martial impulse, the impulse towards its drive, get up and go, the ability to drive through obstacles. It can also be associated with conflict. Mars was the god of war. And when Mars entered into this Uranus-Pluto square, we can see hues of those qualities of Mars, war and conflict. We can also see bravery, Uranus, the sudden, the unexpected, Mars bravery, Pluto, the deep compulsion towards drives, towards goals, a compulsion towards action. So depending on where the Uranus-Pluto square lies in your own personal chart, the Mars crossing of that square will very much activate that and give energy and drive to it for yourself in the particular hue and way that it lands in your own chart. That was mid-November. It began to come into aspect to Uranus through late November, and then into late November again in early December, becoming conjoined with Pluto. So we have the Sun in the sky moving into an opposition with Jupiter, which is stationing in Gemini. So the Sun is now in Sagittarius, early Sagittarius. Jupiter is in Gemini, which is 180 degrees from Sagittarius, right on the exact opposite end of the zodiac. So with Jupiter stationing in Gemini, stationing means that it was retrograding, and it's beginning to stop and get ready to move forward again. It's going to stop and stay still and station in the sky. So those who have their birthdays in early Sagittarius will feel that Jupiter stationing right across from their natal sun, the natal position of their sun in Sagittarius. Jupiter wants to broaden the horizons, wants to incorporate more higher education, more cultural adeptness, more of the external world, incorporate it more into the sun, which is one's basic identity. Jupiter is also associated with fairness and celebration during this time. Once again, those people whose natal sun is in early Sagittarius, those people whose birthdays are late November, early December, will feel or will have felt that Jupiter stationing as kind of a celebration of their basic identity, an urge towards fairness, and also a desire to want to incorporate more of the broader horizons of the external world into one's identity of self. Nothing wrong there, as long as we don't incorporate so much that we have to trim back later. This aspect can be particularly lit up on these Sagittarians' birthdays, because the sun in the sky will be crossing the point where the sun was when they were born, lighting up this dynamic, this opposition between their natal sun and Jupiter. The sun in the sky crossing it, lighting it up, providing a kind of pivotal moment, pivotal day, where those principles come into visible reality. Shortly thereafter, the sun is moving into Capricorn on the solstice, and as it does that in the winter solstice, December 21st, there has been and will continue to be lots of talk about the Mayan calendar. The Mayan were and are keepers of cycles. all different types of cycles, short cycles, long cycles, one of the longest cycles that archaeologists have found. Many scholars believe ends at this time, although there's some argument. Though we've found the record of the cycles, there's some argument about exactly what the cycles are recording, what exactly they're recording with those long cycles. Some scholars believe that the cycles end on, the longest cycle ends on December 21st of this year as the sun enters into Capricorn. I don't have the authority to speak on that, but I can say that shortly after the sun enters into Capricorn, it will cross over the Uranus-Pluto square. It will conjoin with Pluto, square to Uranus, and it will, just like with those Sagittarians and their Jupiter opposite natal sun, it will light up that aspect. So you can see, you can be sure that shortly after, a few days, maybe a week or so after the solstice, when sun enters into Capricorn, the Uranus-Pluto square will be lit up by the sun. The sun will come in and provide a pivotal moment, a pivotal day or two that shows what that Uranus-Pluto square is capable of, that lights up that dynamic, brings it into visible light of consciousness. So that can be in terms of the collective and how the Uranus-Pluto urge towards liberation is functioning in the collective. It can also give us insight into where that Uranus-Pluto square lies in our own personal chart, in our own personal life, where that revolution towards impulse, that impulse towards revolution, rather, falls within our very personal lives. Once again, as the sun crosses that point right around the new year, giving us plenty of excitement as we leave this year behind and enter into the next year. Thank you so much for listening. Once again, my name is James Moran. This is Astrology Update with James Moran, and I can be found at jamesmoran.co, James Moran, JamesMoran.co. I can be emailed with any questions at james@jamesmoran.co. Thank you so much.
During this season of sharing, peace, and goodwill, Firefly Willows LIVE would like to once again acknowledge the following rescue organization and its volunteers for the generous and valuable gift of their time and energies. Firefly Willows LIVE is proud to support Mikaboo Companion Bird Rescue. Founded in 1996 and operating throughout the greater San Francisco Bay Area, Mikaboo is a rescue organization for parrot type and other domesticated companion birds. Their volunteers, the heart and soul of Mikaboo, are dedicated to rescuing companion birds who have been neglected, abused, injured, or surrendered to them, with the ultimate goals of rehabilitation and rehoming these feathered beings. Mikaboo offers bird education classes to people interested in adopting a rescue bird, as well as to the general bird-loving public. Find them at www.mikaboo.org. Mikaboo is spelled M-I-C-K-A-B-O-O. Or email them at mail@mikaboo.org. Information on how to make a donation to help the birds can be found at www.mikaboo.org or by emailing donations@mikaboo.org.
You've got my innocence in you. An offering is different from a gift. An offering is something that once the receiver has claimed ownership, chooses to offer back to the giver of the gift.
My guest today is Yeshe Rabbit. Yeshe Rabbit has been an enthusiastic wanderer along the winding path of esoterica for over 20 years as a devotee of the Holy Church of Laughter, a student of many different spiritual paths, and a lover of life. She is a writer, singer of sacred songs, ritualist, tarot reader, and a feminist futurist. Tracing the roots of women's wisdom through herstory, film, theater, and world myth, Yeshe Rabbit received a BA in English from SUNY Oneonta in New York and an MA in Women's History from Sarah Lawrence College. She is the co-owner of The Sacred Well, a metaphysical shop in Oakland, California, that you can also visit online at www.sacredwell.com. Her intuitive tarot practice gives her the opportunity to read fortunes for seekers near and far. She helps magical folk find their perfect treasures at the Sacred Well, and she serves as the presiding High Priestess of Come As You Are Coven, or Kaya, an eclectic pagan community in the Bay Area that you can find out more about at www.kayacoven.org. Yeshe Rabbit's interests include tarot, herbalism, shamanic and indigenous spiritual practices, myth and storytelling, drumming, singing, ecstatic ritual, plant, stone, and animal lore, and astrology. She has been featured on NPR and is a regular teacher and presenter at local and national gatherings, including the Northern California Women's Herbal Symposium, Pantheacon, the Berkeley Pagan Festival, and many others. Yeshe Rabbit believes in magical, co-creative, dynamic consciousness, and she says that she meanders with a song on her lips, a wicked sense of humor, and with gratitude for the journey. So it is an honor and a privilege to ask you to join me in helping welcome to the show today, Yeshe Rabbit. So thank you, Yeshe Rabbit, for joining me on the show today. It's an honor and a pleasure to have you here to talk about our topic, which is going to be offerings.
Thank you for having me. I'm looking forward to it.
And I do want to let people know that after our little conversation here, Yeshe Rabbit will also be joining us to walk us through a kind of a magical technique or approach to making offerings as well. So I would encourage you to stay tuned and listen for that after the interview. I think what I'd like to start with, if I could, is maybe you could just give people listening a little bit of a background of who you are, where you come from, what's kind of brought you to the current spiritual path and practice that you're at today.
Well, I would say that growing up in a very strongly Catholic household, where my mother also had very strong tendencies toward Buddhism, was for me the root of my practice of devotion. And now on the path of the goddess and in the communion of the whole universe, I apply a lot of the same techniques and practices of reverence, meditation, prayer, intention, and ritual that I learned as a child in the Catholic Church and in doing Buddhist practice to what I do now. Along the way, I have studied goddess spirituality and feminist spirituality. I've been a friend of several different Odisha-based houses of worship. I am a current hoodoo and root work student. I've dipped a toe into Wicca, although I've not been initiated in a Wiccan coven. And all of these different viewpoints of the divine have informed my larger scale current understanding of what I think spiritual truth is. And to me, that's what excites me, the truths that transcend different people's paths. the things that are true no matter where you go. Kindness is true wherever you go. Compassion, the need for compassion is true wherever you go. So that's sort of what's brought me to my path today, and my path today is very eclectic. It's eclectic by necessity, because as I feel tapped by deities or powers or energies, I go in the direction that they lead, and I learn and I follow to a certain point. And beyond a certain point, if I feel like my devotion to that single deity would compromise my devotions that I hold to other deities that are also important to me, then I usually will not take that next step. So you might say that I'm a polytheist in that I have multiple different devotional practices and different deities that I am focused on from very different pantheons. But you also might call me a universalist, because I believe that they all belong to the same ground of being.
And you actually have something called the Way of the Rabbit.
Yeah, the Way of the Rabbit is my approach. It's based on both the lore of Lagomorpha, which is the species that we now know as hares and wild rabbits. This species has been in existence for over 40 million years and has remained, with the exception of geographic alteration and iteration, relatively unchanged. And so to me, the Way of the Rabbit connotes the cyclic existence of humanity. It connotes the lunar nature that I feel connected to, and it connotes a kind of devotion to earth-based practices, herbalism, gardening, and communing with nature as part of my practice.
And probably one of the things that you're most publicly known for is Kaya.
Mm-hmm.
Kaya Coven,
mm-hmm.
or Come As You Are Coven. Can you just give us a little bit of an insight as to where that started and what that is?
Yeah, sure. I started Kaya Coven because of a dream. I was asleep. It was the early morning. It was in 2005, and I had this voice that came into my mind as I was just before I woke up. It was like, you know, when the alarm goes off and then you go back to sleep for a little while and, you know, then the alarm goes off again. It was in one of those kind of interstitial periods. I heard this voice that said, "You're going to start a coven. It's going to be called Come As You Are Coven, and it's going to be a place where everyone can find something that meets their needs." And it was this kind of a command, but not spoken in a harsh way. It was just like, okay, here you go. Here's this truth. And so I started Kaya in 2005. There were three of us, and we would gather in my living room. And by late 2005, we had become 13, and we started to open our rituals to more and more eclectic practitioners. And the concept behind Kaya is that we all are unique individuals with unique spiritual practices, and we all bring those beliefs and practices to the table and share them together in the spirit of generosity, but without presumption that any one way is the right way. We're all about the creativity and the exploration that is possible when people of varying backgrounds get together and try to find the common sacred ground. We've just celebrated our 8th Samhain, and that's a very big deal. And we're almost a decade old, and there are 35 full-time clergy who serve in Kaya in three different traditions. The Wildflower Collective, which is our main training tradition for public clergy service for both men and women. The Green Men, which is a men's mystery tradition, and the Bloodroot Honey Priestess Tribe, which is a women's mysteries tradition. And together, we form a basis of clergy that is dedicated to public service and gathers around common protocol, policy, ethics, and structure, as opposed to gathering around any single religious dogma.
And I think something you said in terms of that formation and everything is how you would come together, sit down, and everybody would offer what they had to bring in a spirit of generosity,
mm-hmm.
As well as I think a lot of what Kaya does very much ties into what we're talking about today, which is kind of the overall theme of offering and making offerings.
Make a sacred offering to the gods of infinitesimal detail.
This is the time of year when we start especially being more focused on gift giving and receiving.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that what it means to give and receive has gotten lost under the consumer and commercial aspect and sheen of everything. But I also think, especially in terms of a spiritual practice, that giving gifts and offerings, it's a very different kind of thing than what we think of in terms of giving gifts, especially with this time of year, with the holidays and everything, and what people associate with the whole gift-giving idea. And I think some people approach their spiritual practice that way.
Well, I think you're right, and I think that that's the trouble when we start to conflate the two. In my experience, gifts in the secular sense are this sort of mandatory social currency that come along with holidays or with a visit to someone's home or as a signifier of peace or goodwill between two people who might not know each other very well. And therefore, gifts in the secular sense are not always as intimate as what we might give in an offering in a spiritual sense, where to me, the offering is about the mutuality of adoration that is happening in a moment between a human and the divine.
Offerings represent the love or attraction to the beauty of the gods, and they represent the love flowing from the gods to us, that we receive from them and return to them in order to honor them and express our love and appreciation for them.
Our offerings are meaningless without love.
I dare say, I might even say that I think animals make offerings in their own way. If you've ever stood and watched in a field of rabbits, them kind of frolicking around and playing, sometimes they'll bring little like sticks or other things. Birds do this too, bring sticks or other little things and kind of leave them in a little arrangement. And it's only meaningful to the animal. It's not necessarily something we will understand when we look at it. But I like to think that that's their tribute to their own gods. But I'd like to also say that I think that the concept of gift giving is less tied to reverence than the concept of offering. The concept of offering seems to be tied to a reverence, and that the reverence is about intimacy and establishing mutuality and sharing a piece of yourself from your heart, as opposed to what we might see in just, you know, I run down and I buy so-and-so a pair of socks or a new tie and I wrap it up and I just give it to them. So there's like a difference there.
And I think that one difference that I feel between gift and offering is gift is often associated with a material thing. And offering, while it can be something material, offering is something that comes from you. Not just a thing you're giving to, but something that is coming from you. And tied into that, I think what makes an offering is the intention or the motivation behind what is being offered or given. You know, what you just described, running down to the store, grabbing a tie, you know, wrapping it up to give to somebody because you're going over to their house or whatever. The intention behind that or the motivation behind that is more obligation.
Mm-hmm.
Or, well, you know, I have to give something.
Mm-hmm.
Or it's their birthday, so we're supposed to give something.
Right.
Whereas an offering, especially from a spiritual practice, an offering is something where the motivation is pure. it's reciprocal in the sense of what comes from the gods we're willing to give back to them. So mm-hmm. even if it's giving bread or mm-hmm. incense or water, it's still something that came from them that we're giving back. But to me, offerings are not given with the intention of getting, receiving, or asking for something from the gods.
Right.
And I know this can be a gray area. For example, you have a lot of experience in the Orisha tradition. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you could see a gray area there because a lot of times what's given is kind of given as a request or a bribe, if we wanted to be a bit.
Well, I would say that I've seen it done in certain ways so that the offering becomes a negotiation point or a point of barter. I think that that is located within a spiritual context where the exchange of energy is the form of worship. So when the exchange of energy of, all right, so-and-so, deity, Orisha, saint, even in the Catholic tradition, I know I grew up promising Saint Anthony money in the poor box if he would help me find lost things. You say, all right, I'd like to give you this thing, and I'd like you to do this for me. It's a particular type of cultural context where the act of mutual exchange of energy in that way becomes the spiritual practice or has roots in an understanding of the economy of the culture where it originates. Whereas in other cultures, we see the concept of offering being much more structured and elaborate about we ask nothing, we give the very finest of what we have, we take the best fruits of the tree from the tree and we place them on the altar and then we don't touch them because those belong to the Godhead or the divine being. And then that's also contrasted with the concept of prasad, where we bring the offering, we give it to the deity, we deconsecrate it afterwards, and we take that into ourselves as also homage to the deity, that the consumption of the substance is a part of the, by the human, is a part of the offering. So I think that when it comes to it, we're looking at shades of meaning along that gift continuum, or shades of meaning along that offerings continuum. On one end of that spectrum, or in one quadrant of that sphere, there is that idea that it's predicated upon that your offering actually is your act of negotiation, that coming to the deity asking for something is part of what you offer them, in that you're offering them your faith. In another aspect, it's you're offering them literal physical material goods or art or poetry or performances of theater, like we see in ancient Greece or in some of the ritual plays that we see of the Middle Ages in sacred theater, that the act of doing the thing or making the thing is in and of itself the offering. And then there's that, and that the base there is we ask for nothing, and that's the spiritual nature of the offering. And then with the concept of prasad, it's understanding that the divine is all-encompassing and we are a part of it, and therefore our taking in of the substance at the end of the ceremonial enactment is acknowledging the divine within ourselves by being both the giver and the receiver, and knowing that we are not divisible from that Godhead. And so it's sort of this spectrum of kind of how that all can happen and what each type of offering might mean located in its culture.
The reciprocity of offerings is not because we are expecting gifts from the gods. It is reciprocal because love freely flows back and forth,
back and forth,
from gods to man,
from gods to,
from
man,
gods to man,
from gods to man,
to God.
Prasad probably illustrates what I tend to think of with offerings, which is it's a reciprocal aspect, you know, but it's like a circle. It's a never ending reciprocity. So it's what comes from the gods we then want to offer back, but then what we've offered to them comes back to us, and then we offer again. Mm-hmm. And when we eat the food in some traditions, when we eat the food that we have offered, it's not just giving us physical nourishment, but it's now really imbued with that divinity of the god or goddess that we have offered it to. And we're also able to take in, to ingest that divine essence.
Mm-hmm.
And then from that comes a closer connection, a closer appreciation, a closer awareness of that divine being. Mm-hmm. And so we now want to give again.
Right.
Which then comes back to us.
Right. Because that internalization of the divine being then imbues us with the generosity that that divine being has been for all of eternity and has been in the act of giving us our earth or creating us. It's like it's a complete circle. It's feeding back into that same generative force.
Right. Like in my tradition, in the Kemetic tradition, frankincense is seen as the exudation of Ra. So that has come to us, but that's a very, very sacred and traditional offering to then make in ritual back to the deity. For me, offerings are not about asking for something. That's when you bring a gift.
Right, right.
But that reciprocity, I think, and the motivation behind what you're offering, mm-hmm. is something that I often gets lost with people, because what people seem to do a lot of times is they consult a list. Like at Christmas, what do? We make a list, mm-hmm. we give it to our mother, or, you know, we give it to our brother, and it has a list of the things that we want, and then they go and they get something that's on our list. And in a spiritual practice, I see people do that all the time. So if somebody was coming to do a ritual to Bast, the first thing that they'll do is they'll look up on the internet a list of offerings that are supposed to be made to Bast.
Right.
And while that's okay, if you're really genuinely interested to see what was given or what has been traditional because I want to try to do something that is honorable, etc., that's fine. But I think a lot of people use that as a shortcut, mm-hmm. and they don't want to have to do the work themselves,
mm-hmm.
to offer from a place of this is what is right to be offering. Because it's easier for me to look on a list and it says chocolates, fine, I can just go down to the store and get some chocolates and then I can make this offering. But I don't know how pure the motivation is there,
right.
necessarily. But I think it also speaks to a question that I'll ask you, is what you think the difference between a sacrifice and an offering is.
Well, I think I want to address the first part and then I'll go into the question. The idea of offering based on, you know, a list, these are the traditional things offered to a particular deity, I can see where that's a very helpful thing for someone who's a beginner, because if you're just starting out, it's like when you visit a country that you've never been to before, you really want to take a little time and read what the customs of the country are ahead of time and know what to expect a little bit, so that when you get there, you won't make a fool of yourself, right? I get that. I definitely don't want to make a fool of myself in front of the gods, although I think I do all the time. And I think that if they can derive laughter from that, then my offering is complete, right? But I also can see where equivocation around those lists, for example, if traditionally a deity receives honey, oranges, blossoms from a particular type of tree, to go buy a can of Orange Crush and give that to the deity because it's kind of like an orange, that equivocation is where I think that we sometimes fall into that slippery slope. And so being mindful that if we're working from a list and we find that we don't have access to anything from that list, that the next thing to do is to find the most sacred thing that you are capable of offering at the time, even if that means going off the list, is going to land you with a more reverent offering than if you just tried to equivocate. Now, when we move into the realm of looking at the variance between sacrifice and offering, whereas an offering seems to be, in many cultural traditions, given freely, in many cultural traditions, sacrifice seems to be a price. Like, you owe the deity something. This is a payment. This is a something that costs you. And so the concept of sacrifice, you know, I'd like to talk a little bit about the way we do it in Kaya. Every year in Kaya, we have in August our Lammas ritual, which we've chosen to move away from the Celtic names because we're not all practicing Celtic magic. So we've renamed it the Festival of Heart and Harvest. And at this ritual, every year, we typically create an effigy of straw and maybe another effigy of straw or wood or fabric or something like that. And we imbue those effigies with the sense of our joyful service, our open hearts, our willingness to take risks, our willingness to give of ourselves for the divine and for our community. And then we sacrifice the effigies, where we put one into a fire and we usually put one into the water, where it's the message for us is, ignite me with the passion to be of service. The immersion is, immerse me in the waves of opportunity to be of service. And so our idea of sacrifice has been to sort of take it away from that, this is your payment, into that sacrifice contains the spirit of offering, as opposed to it having to hurt you or cost you in some way.
Well, and I would say in every sacrifice there is offering, but every offering doesn't have to involve sacrifice.
Yeah.
When I think of when you were saying if somebody decided to do an orange crush can rather than an actual orange, that to me is the avoidance of wanting to have to sacrifice. It's like, I don't want to spend the time or the effort to go down to the store and get an orange because I have a can of orange crush right here. And that's orange enough.
Right.
And, you know, so we don't even want to sacrifice 10 minutes of our time
right. Or
inconvenience in order to offer something to the gods.
Right. And it seems like in that case, it would be better to either look around at what you have that's actually meaningful to you and for the purpose of what you're, you know, how you're choosing to commune with the deity, and give that, even if it's not from the list. Or the other thing is, sometimes it's really just worth it to take the time and say, maybe I don't have the things I need right here, right now. Let me take the time to go procure them, to set the energy correctly, to be really mindful about it, and then approach with my offering in a more formal fashion, rather than just kind of dashing it off, tossing a can of Coke into a glass, setting it on the altar and running off to work because you only had 5 minutes. And, you know, that's not to like put anyone down for having that kind of schedule. I know lots of people who have two-year-olds, and a two-year-old, I'll tell you, they will keep you from making offerings. They will distract you. They will take your offerings and put them into, you know, somewhere that they shouldn't be. I know lots of people who work full-time. I know lots of people who are caring for ailing parents. There's lots of reasons why in your daily life you might have a hard time setting aside that hour to prepare your perfect soda bread to put in front of, you know, this deity, or your ideal, creating the ideal song or poem to recite before the deity. But when you do get a chance to do that, do it and make it count. One of the precepts that comes up very frequently in my Buddhist training and has appeared in other magical areas of my life will be that when we're talking about giving mantra or recitation of particular chants to a deity as a gift, as an empowerment, as an offering, it's said, you know, chant this 108 times. If you can't chant it 108 times, chant it 64 times. If you can't chant it 64 times, chant it 32 times. If you can't chant it 32 times, chant it 16 times. If you can't manage to even chant it 16 times, chant it once, but chant it well. And that's, to me, the essence of offering, is that regardless of however humble the offering, nor how elaborate the offering, you know, either way, neither is more or less important. They each have their place, but it's the manner in which it's given that gives it that mana or that power, that chi, that sense of the divine communion.
It is not by the amount that giving is productive of reward, but rather by the generous impulse behind it.
Even so little as a handful of ripe flour given with a pure heart becomes something that will bring great reward.
We've heard about it for a generation or more. Now it's here, the end of the Mayan calendar's great cycle.
It's a time of great change, and we are the change makers.
We are the ones we've been waiting for.
Solstice 2012, 100 hearts drumming the rhythm of rebirth. At Stillheart, Friday, December 21st.
A new beginning awaits.
Join in the power of community and sacred ceremony as we shed our collective past. Drum, dance, and sing in celebration as we usher in this new age of collaboration and unity.
Visit fireflywillows.com/solstice2012 for all the details.
Truly, this opportunity will come only once in your lifetime.
Friday, December 21st at Stillheart in Woodside. Come join us. Be part of the rebirth.
fireflywillows.com/solstice2012. Register today.
A sacred offering to the gods of infinitesimal detail.
We return to our conversation with Yeshe Rabbit. You know, the word sacrifice means to make sacred. So when you were talking about taking the time to go down to the store and get this, or like if I'm setting up my altar and I realize I need flowers, I will make a special trip to the store to get flowers for the altar. But I will not say, oh, well, since I'm going to be at the store anyway, let me go ahead and make this little list of other things that I need, and I'll pick up some groceries and stuff too, and I'll make sure to grab some flowers while I'm there as well. Because if I specifically set aside the time and the energy to go down to the store and get those flowers for the altar, in essence, what I'm doing is I'm making the act of going to shop and buy flowers a sacred act.
Right.
So I'm making a sacrifice by making the motivation and the energy behind what I'm doing sacred and not combining it with other things to where it's something that simply is convenient or a side note to something else that I'm doing just mm-hmm. because I'm going to the store.
Yes.
And I think that's what's also important is, again, it comes back to that motivation. And sacrifice doesn't mean something elaborate all of the time, nor something painful, like you said. It just means approaching it and doing it with an act of sacredness and an intention of sacredness behind why and what you're doing and the purpose that you're doing it for, rather than, well, if I can slip in time or a way to get that thing that I need for the god, I'll do it.
Right.
You know, and I think also, like when you're talking about the people with two-year-old kids and, you know, all that kind of stuff, I think people also get a little bit stuck in thinking that offerings are something physical. And I don't know that the gods are necessarily looking down in judgment about are you offering me the right thing?
Right.
So much as they're looking at what's your motivation, and you know, is your intention pure behind what you're doing? So the person that has the two-year-old kids, the sacrifice I would say that the gods would be looking for would be more, are you willing to sacrifice 5 minutes of sleep time in order to simply come and sit after the kids are in bed and commune with me at your altar?
Exactly.
And that is both a sacrifice of 5 minutes of sleep time that are probably very precious to someone with kids.
Yes,
like that.
Absolutely.
But it's also an offering, because it's a pure motivation, but it's an offering. This is what I have to give. This is all I have to offer. But for the gods, that's enough.
That's right.
We get caught up in ego that thinks it needs to be something more, something better, something greater, something whatever. And if we stop looking at it both from a material standpoint of what am I offering, as well as is it enough versus my motivation and my intention is what makes it enough, quote unquote, then that is all that the gods are really asking of us. And that to me is not, you don't have to sacrifice getting a babysitter to go to the store to get the right kind of food to offer to the god kind of thing.
Right.
Versus simply sacrifice 5 minutes of sleep time that before you go to bed that you would love to have, but are willing to give that and offer that to the god instead.
Right.
Instead of holding on to it for yourself.
Right.
The offering of religious practice is what pleases the gods the most and creates a bond between them and the practitioner.
It's really about setting aside room for special, whatever level of special that is. And in that, I also think that human beings can honor the divine through giving that set aside something special to each other. If part of my practice, which it is to honor the divine in each being, then sometimes my offering might not be to sit at my altar. Sometimes my offering might be to sit and listen to an elderly woman tell her stories about her life that nobody else is listening to because society has shunted her away and decided that she's no longer valuable because she's no longer sexualized. And my offering to the crone goddess is to sit before this human woman and just have patience for her to tell me her stories or the truths that she holds dear. I think about this one song that I've written, which is my shaman song, and it is a song that has never been written down, and I won't allow it to be written down. I don't write any of the words. I don't have the words written down anywhere. When I sing that song, it is for a specific purpose, and everyone who hears that song in the vicinity is given an opportunity to witness and partake of the offering that I'm giving in the unseen world by listening to that song. And so it's important to me that it not get written down. It's important to me that those words don't get trapped on a piece of paper somewhere, even if it was with good intention to write it on the piece of paper and then just hang it above the altar so that it was always there, right? But that's not the point. The point is there's an enactment, and it's me singing for the benefit of anyone who is assembled here, human or non-human, in an act of reverence to create a beneficial energy in the unseen world that will create peace, even if I don't see that peace in this world right away. So to that end, I think of offering as something that you can do as a practice to other human beings in their mode as points of divine power or bits of the divine embodied. And I think that our service to each other, anything that we do that's of service, being a friend of one of those parents of two-year-olds and being willing to say, hey, on Friday night, do you and your sweetie want to go out to a movie? I'll stay home with the little one, can be something that's me being of that midwife goddess. You know, now I'm honoring the Artemis. I'm honoring energy of the goddess who comes and says, you need some time alone, and I can tell. You know, there are times when, for me, choosing to give money to a homeless person is me taking a moment to say, oh, and this is somebody who represents the divine trickster. Maybe there's like some person sitting on the corner drinking a cup of coffee, telling jokes to passersby and asking for change. And I know I'm in the presence of the trickster. And so I honor the trickster. I listen to the joke. I, you know, laugh. I give an offering of my laughter where so many people just walk by this man all day long and don't listen. I might give him $1, $2, $3. And I say thank you for the joke. I'm feeding his spirit. I'm feeding his pocket. And for me, that act of nourishment is the offering more than, say, the $3 I would give him. It's the act of paying attention.
The giver acquires the greatest merit when a person is motivated by a wish to attain enlightenment for the sake of all sentient beings. A gift made with a very pure motivation to a needy person is exalted because without them, we would not have the opportunity to practice giving.
Making a modest gift with an exalted motivation to a needy person is far greater than one made with a poor motivation to a deity.
And I think in what you've just talked about there, for me, probably would describe the essence of what offering is, especially compared to gift, if we want to play semantics. And offering is when what we are giving is done selflessly.
Mm-hmm.
And in selflessness. Because what you are describing, you're doing it for the benefit of all beings.
Yeah.
You're not offering just for your own enlightenment, just for your own benefit, just for your own whatever you might be asking for in order to get back. You're offering simply to offer because you know that it is for the all, which ultimately then also becomes for the gods as well. They're part of the all.
They're part of the all. They're in it.
Yes.
You're soaking in it.
That's
the
right.
Universe, you soak in it.
Because they are refreshed,
mm-hmm,
and revived,
mm-hmm,
and honored through that process as well. And, you know, in Kemeticism, that's why we do ritual, is because we're refreshing the ka. We refresh, mm-hmm, the spirit of the divine being. You know, and the argument could be made, do they need that? Not necessarily, but on this plane, in order to remain relevant or vibrant on this plane. That is needed. There's a reciprocity because we can't exist without them, for sure.
Right.
They also, in some ways, need us to, not to exist, but on this plane, to be, mm-hmm, as existent, as fully
everyone
as possible.
Everyone has their part.
Yeah.
All of us have our part, right? The deities have their part. We have our part. If we weren't there to build temples, it's not that they wouldn't exist. It's that their presence on this plane would be more difficult to notice for the vast majority of people who are not awakened.
And their energy is so vast.
Yeah.
And that, you know, a temple or an image gives a focal point for that energy to come into. Really, what I think is for us as humans to be able to comprehend them.
Yeah.
And without that, it's not that they don't exist. It just is they don't have that presence or comprehension for us,
mm-hmm,
on that level.
That's right.
And making the offering allows that ability to make that comprehension known to us on this level, refreshed and vibrant on an ongoing basis.
You know, I read a book by Emily Post, Emily Post's Blue Book of Manners. It's, you may be familiar with it.
My grandparents made me read an Emily Post book when I was young.
My grandmother made me read this one. And I have never regretted reading this book. And in fact, this was when I was very small that I read it. In fact, about 2-3 years ago, I was in a store and I found Emily Post's granddaughter, I think daughter or granddaughter, had basically pulled the best of the Blue Book and put it in a smaller volume. And so I just picked that up. I said, well, this will probably be enough to refresh all of those lessons. She wrote in the introduction that she had continued the work of her mother or grandmother because of the meaning behind Emily Post's Guide to Manners, and that Emily Post had said that good manners are the natural vessel into which we pour our inborn desire to be of benefit to each other and to be good to each other. And that over time, the way that manners had come to be so hardened into social forms as opposed to spontaneous acts of natural goodwill in a prepared and organized fashion, you know, kind of taking that spontaneous good feeling and then putting it into a form, that's what good manners are really all about. And that over time, it's really not about the fork, right? It's not about which fork you eat with. It's not about your napkin in your lap. It's not about if you send thank you notes 1 week or 2 weeks after the event. Those details are social conventions, and they strip the manners of their original intention sometimes, becoming constrictive.
Offering is an action which is spontaneous, natural, and bountiful.
The minute we get too focused on the manner of offering and the going through the motions, especially if it gets to the point where going through the motions no longer makes our heart leap with the innocent joy of giving, that's when we've turned our offering into more of like a social gift. Mm-hmm. And it's the spontaneity of goodwill, that shy child going and running out behind the school and picking a dandelion and bringing it in for the teacher who she loves, who protects her from the bullies in her class. That's, to me, the most kind of pure offering. She's able to, it's her way of saying so many things in one. There's a thank you. There's an I love you. There's an I feel safe with you. There's I want to please you. I want to do something for you. I'm reflecting your goodness in it. And I think that as we grow up, you know, we can maintain that kind of innocent way of giving. We can certainly just run out and grab a flower, you know, or a weed from the garden and bring that in. And as long as it's done with a very pure heart, I think that's perfectly fine. But I also think that adults have sophisticated minds and enjoy sophisticated challenges. And sometimes thinking, how will I take this goodwill that I have and pour it into a form that will be pleasing, can be the gift that we're giving or the offering that we're giving to ourselves in doing, in preparing what it is that we're going to give to the divine. And it's that I enjoy applying form to this natural, spontaneous feeling. I enjoy making it formal. And our enjoyment of that is part of the offering. So you can see inside that where there's these like infinite multiple layers of offering, that the substance is the offering, the act is the offering, the intention is the offering, the love that motivated the intention is also the offering. I would like to say that if that is conscious at every step, you've done a great offering. And even when parts of that are not conscious but have become woven into your everyday goodwill, you will find that you're living in a world where everything you do is an offering from your heart. And then it's never, I have to tell you this, for me, this concept destabilizes so many questions that are ego-based around whether or not my offering is good enough or whether or not anything I do is good enough. Because when it's not about whether or not it's going to be measured according to propriety or according to the deity's, you know, yardstick of good versus bad offerings. And instead, it's just going to be received as the energetic substance that it is, whether it's in a, you know, a package or whether it's in an act. I then live in this world that's populated by always good enough. Always good enough because it's done with a good heart. Always good enough and always room for improvement and joy toward improvement, rather than feeling that your improvements over time in your skillfulness in offerings needs to somehow be based on a punitive idea of your gods. And so, like, that's just like so many layers of my growing up religion that has just been totally sliced away, that I didn't have to process through, and I didn't have to like wonder, oh, you know, if I say I'm going to grow papyrus in my garden for Isis, that's what I'm going to do. And then every time I water the papyrus, that's a prayer to Isis. Every time I stand there and I stroke the fronds, it's a prayer to Isis. And I don't stand there and I don't wonder, is Isis pleased with this papyrus? Does she think that it's good enough? Should I get a bigger papyrus? You know, I never wonder that. If I sing a song from my heart and my voice cracks on a note because I'm filled with emotion, I'm not going to flagellate myself, oh, my voice cracked on that note and that made it sound bad, or those people were listening. If I'm standing in a ritual and I'm priestessing for a ritual with 100 people in it and I forget one small part of an enactment and then say, oh, but wait, no, I'm sorry, forgive me, we have to go back and do this part to make it correct, I'm not worried about, like, did that just ruin the whole ritual and 100 people's karma is all messed up? Like, no, it's because I returned to that innocent intention. And I actually think that we live in a culture that has so many layers of sophistication that we've forgotten how important innocence is. Over time, the meshing of the innocent intention with the artful comportment is the fabric of one's spiritual practice.
Well, everything you were describing there, I've decided I'm going to call it the spiral of reciprocity.
Oh, yes, I like that.
Because the joy that the God gets from receiving the offering, you thinking about how can I express this, you know, offering to the God, brings you joy. Well, we have the joy that the divine being is getting from receiving it, but then the reciprocity is I'm now receiving joy through the act of offering, and the joy that I felt is going to make me want to do it again. So now that the God is pleased again, which means I'm going to be in joy and enjoy doing it again.
Mm-hmm.
And whatever we do with that purity of motivation is enough. But that doesn't mean it can't grow and evolve to be something more. But like a spiral, it's not a circle that just keeps coming back around to the same point. Like a spiral, it moves to the next level and then it comes around. But now we're offering at a different level and that joy is at a different level. And so it made me think I'm going to now start thinking of that offering process as a spiral of reciprocity.
I love it, the spiral of reciprocity. Well, I think you're right. I think we've come to the core of it, which is that the natural result of a gift is consumption, and the natural result of an offering is another offering.
The natural result of a gift is consumption, and the natural result of an offering is
the natural result of a gift is consumption, and the natural result of an offering is
the natural result of a gift is consumption, and the natural result of an offering is another offering.
So as we are coming to the close of our conversation here, one of the things I like to do with each guest at the end of our conversation is, one, I will have you ask a question that you would like to hear the response of my next guest give. Without knowing who that is, simply ask the question. And secondly, I will ask you the question that my previous guest had, and we will hear what your response is to that. So, first of all, what question would you like to pose to the next guest that will be on?
What do you need to forgive yourself for?
What do you need to forgive yourself for?
What do you need to forgive yourself for?
And my previous guest last month was Darren Hollingsworth, a philanthropy coach. And his question was, what do you have to be grateful for in your work?
Oh, I am grateful to be in a state of right livelihood. I feel like my mission and purpose of service are in alignment with my livelihood, and that my livelihood supports my ability to be in ever widening arcs of service joyfully. And for me, that is absolutely the most important thing. I'm a Taurus, and so to be able to be in a state of joyful service and right livelihood for my work is something that is incredibly important to me, and I am so very grateful for that opportunity.
To close our little conversation here, because I know that you also work with the Tarot, as do I, I'm thinking that we are going to perhaps draw a card and simply ask a question to the Tarot of, what is an offering?
Wonderful.
And we will see what comes up and what it is that we feel that that says to us about what an offering is.
Let's do it.
So as we ask the question, what is an offering? What we see has come up as we have turned over the card is the Two of Wands or the Two of Fire.
Possibilities. In my practice, the Two of Wands represents trust and building trust. And so for me, looking at the Two of Wands as the card of offering, the greatest offering we have to give any deity is not material. It is, in fact, our trusting heart and trusting that the journey that we are on with that deity is, in fact, our divine path, inspired and embodied in everything that we do. As I look at this card, the possibilities of whatever may come are very present. And knowing that I get to walk beside the divine, the goddess, the universe, the many names by which we would know that all, is the gift that I can give. It's my trust that whatever comes up, I'm going to be able to handle it together with my divine powers.
And I think that touches on both the number, which is two, as well as this card for me oftentimes indicates partnership, especially like a business partnership or a creative partnership. And so in that regard, there's a sense, and two is a number of partnership as well, and relationship. And so there's a sense with this card that in making offerings, we enter into partnership and relationship with the divine or the god or goddess that we are offering, or the person or the thing that we are making an offering to. Here we have the Suit of Wands, which is fire, which we could see a little bit of the sacrifice aspect because we often think of that in terms of putting something into the fire as a sacrifice. But there's a whole purging and lighting a flame, if you will, mm-hmm. which it brings that illumination. And sometimes there is, you know, that joy can burn within us from making that offering, as well as the desire to make the offering. Because really, I think that desire for making the offering is the desire to be in closer communion and relationship and partnership with the divine or that particular divinity. And, you know, Two of Wands gives us a sense that there's unlimited possibility and potential for what offering not only can be, but for what it is that we can offer. We just have to see that what we have to offer or what can be offered isn't always confined to a traditional list,
mm-hmm.
or a right or wrong or enough or not enough in terms of an amount of something, versus allow ourselves to see what possibility and potential there is in what we have available to offer and be willing to do that, rather than to hold back or not do it until we think we have enough or the right thing. Well, thank you, Yeshe Rabbit, for having joined me and been willing to engage in this conversation about offerings, and for having offered your time and wisdom and experience to all of those listening.
Thank you, Heisi, for having me on the show. I feel like your offering of this show is so much fun to listen to. I get so much out of it. You have fascinating guests, and I'm very grateful to be counted among their number.
So as we move into our next segment, Yeshe Rabbit is going to lead us through an offering ritual that you can perform on your own anytime that you choose. And it is a process that helps you to tap into and express the generosity that you have in order to move beyond egocentric aspects within yourself.
Ego attachments to our fears or our exaltations. The most precious gift any of us has to offer is time, because it is the one thing in our lives that is in fact limited. So begin this ritual by choosing to set aside an amount of time to do each part so that you can deepen into the practice with a sense that giving of your time is the ground of the ritual. Thus, the ritual that will come after will be rooted in the offering of this most precious commodity. This is a three-part offering ritual. You can do it in one whole day, or you can do it on three separate days. The first part of the ritual is going to involve the preparation of a physical offering. The second part of the ritual is going to involve the preparation of an artistic offering. And the third part of the ritual is going to involve the preparation of a meditational offering of self. In a certain sense, one might look at this process of offering through a shamanic lens or through a Buddhist lens as the act of feeding your demons. However, you can choose to, instead of giving this offering to an embodied deity, give it to a situation, another human being, either in person or spiritually at a distance. Or you might choose to do altar work with this ritual and work with a deity that you find complex, disturbing, or frightening. Begin by identifying a situation or person in your life that you find difficult, vexatious, or troublesome. Take the time to think about this person or situation. And if you choose to work with a deity in this offering ritual, identify the deity who most closely represents the energy of the situation at hand. So, for example, you might, if you were thinking about a legal situation that you're dealing with, decide that you will appeal to Justitia, the Roman goddess of justice. You may find that you will give this offering to the spirit of the person who wronged you. You may find that you will give this offering on behalf of all those who have gone through your similar circumstance. The main point is that you identify exactly who this offering will be for. And you make that concrete in your mind and in your intention. In the first part of the ritual, dedicate the merit of what you are about to do to that circumstance, that being, or those beings that you're choosing to give this offering to. Make a humble and simple prayer in which you deliver the offering. I, Yesha Rabbit, stand here before you, person, situation, or deity, and I give this offering that myself, all beings, and others might experience the wisdom of this set of circumstances of or of your power or of your presence. The first part of the offering is to prepare something from scratch, a food item, or perhaps some kind of a beverage that you've squeezed by hand. Perhaps it's a libation of beer or wine that you brewed yourself. Perhaps it's a concoction of oils and herbs. Be creative and design an offering that represents the very best of your skills. Make it purposeful and beautiful. If it's a food or drink offering, arrange it artfully on the plate or pour it into a beautiful glass or vessel. Take the time to adorn the offering, placing flowers, leaves, or fresh herbs upon it. If it's a concoction that you've mixed up of essential oils, flowers, and herbs, take the time to place it in a glass vessel or crystal that will allow the beauty of the concoction to be seen. Stand before an altar upon which you have placed items that represent the situation, person, persons, or deity to whom you are making this offering. And then, softly and gently and in a measured way, process forth with your offering held at your heart to that altar. Standing before that altar, speak to the individual or individuals or the deity or the circumstance at hand, describing the offering that you have made in reverent words. Here I stand before you, bearing this humble gift of fresh fruits, of wine that I brewed from fruits I grew upon my own trees or vines. I ask that you receive this offering with the fullness of my heart, my joyful gift to you. and that it be pleasing to you. In the next portion, you will think about that situation at hand, or that person or persons or deity, and you will create an artistic representation of the wisdom that they represent in your life. So, for example, let's say you've chosen a conflict with a friend as the situation at hand. Envision that friend. Envision the moment of that conflict. Take the time to find the beauty in that moment and the wisdom in that moment. The beauty of that moment might be that even though she stood before you angry and wrathful, shouting or arguing or crying, that you were able to look upon her and still notice the beauty of the curve of her cheek or the passion in her words. Think about the wisdom that came forward from that situation. You learned more about this person, her sensitivities, her triggers. Think about the vast depth of friendship that is possible when we acknowledge all parts of a person, even the parts that we find challenging or troublesome. Write that, or speak that, or sing that, or dance that, or enact that wisdom and beauty in front of the altar, in front of the image you've conjured, and give it as an offering from your heart. It's a spontaneous creation, and it will only happen this once. Make it worthwhile. Make it real and deep. In the third part of this ritual, you will then sit and close your eyes and go into a meditative state or trance. And in this meditative state or trance, you will call into your vision the circumstance, person, persons, or deity that is the focal point of this enactment. And you will stand there in this vision before them, stripped naked, your clothing gone, your mirrors and masks gone and cast aside. You stand there as your full self, and you say, I have given you the fruits of my labors. I have given you the art of my spirit. And now I give you the only other thing that I can give, which is my very self. Envision taking all the best parts of yourself and placing them in service to this circumstance or person. You might even go so far as to shamanically envision the deity form ritually dismembering you and consuming the parts of your body. Give with joy. Give with non-attachment. Give with selflessness. Make sure all is consumed in this offering. Envision yourself in servitude toward the greater good of this being or situation. Give it completely. Empty yourself in this act. And then give one last thing, which is your gratitude for having been able to perform this enactment. Invite the deity or person, persons or circumstance to take your gratitude also. Nothing is left behind. Nothing is wasted. All has been consumed in this reverent offering. Give thanks to your own inner teacher for whatever wisdom has come from this or will come from it. take some time later in a journal or in a personal meditation at your own altar to reflect upon this which you created, this ritual which you performed, and any insights that may have returned to you after performing the ritual. Often, the giving of this ritual will transform the circumstance at hand. We don't do this ritual because we want to change our own outcome. We do this ritual because the comfort of the other person, circumstance, or the deity is of paramount importance to us. In stripping away our own ego attachments to outcome, we generate the potential for the best possible outcome for all beings, and that includes ourselves. Therefore, we are no longer separate from the circumstance, from the person, from the deity, but in fact, we locate ourselves, the person, circumstance, and deity within the great matrix of generosity that gives forth this entire universe, that accepts without critique or comment all that is dead, dying, and decaying back to be regenerated and transformed. And in this act, we dedicate ourselves in a selfless way to the highest benefit of all beings, emblematized by this one situation, which, until we had this perspective, seemed so important. I wish you all very great peace. I wish you all harmony and bliss. And when peace, harmony, and bliss are not present, I wish you the wisdom and discernment to do what must be done to restore them. Blessed be, blessed be, blessed be.
Up next is your opportunity to receive a live reading on the air. Skype in from the show page or call 646-716-5510. I'll also be introducing you to my new co-host, Charlie, who will be joining me on a new show that we're starting on Tuesday, December 11th at 8 p.m. called The Amethyst Oracle. Get a sneak peek of that, as well as your chance to get a reading live on the air by Skyping in or calling 646-716-5510, and we'll be right back.
Enjoying today's show? Want to share it with a friend? Or maybe you've missed one of our previous programs. Well, you can always find the archives of our past shows on fireflywillows.com/live. Stop by and check out High C's previous programs, or shows from one of our other hosts, Mildred Lynn McDonald or John Carosella. Our live call-in shows are available too. Join us.
And welcome back. And I am joined at this moment by my co-host for the Amethyst Oracle, Charlie. Hello,
well,
Charlie.
Well, hello there. How are you doing?
I am good. And thank you for taking a few moments to join us on the show today.
My pleasure.
I'm wondering if, first of all, I think we should give people a little bit of an idea of what our show is going to be. And so the show is called The Amethyst Oracle, Divination with a Queer Twist.
Bum, bum, bum.
And it's going to be a new show that is airing underneath the Firefly Willows live channel. So you can find it right here on Blog Talk at blogtalkradio.com/fireflywillows live. And the first show will be on this coming Tuesday, December 11th at 8 p.m. Pacific. So, Charlie, could you give us a little idea of who you are?
Who am I? Well, I am a tarot reader, among other things, and I've been reading the cards for about 16 years now, and I'm very excited to be doing this show with you, Heisey. I've really enjoyed Firefly Willow's podcast, especially today's episode was really fantastic with rabbits. But back to me. As well as being a tarot reader, I am a big old homo, and I'm loving the idea of marrying the two things and exploring them in this podcast. Does that almost answer the question?
It does. It does. So, what's your? How do you see us combining those two things on the new show?
Well, I think it's going to be sort of, it'll be a little bit Star Trek. We're exploring sort of an unseen, unplumbed depth and a vast frontier here. Because Mo's have been reading tarot for a long time, but I've never really seen a book on what that their particular experience might be, or if there's anything unusual about queer spirituality and divination. I've seen it mentioned in certain books on queer spirituality that there's a shamanic connection with being GLBT, but I'm really excited that in a podcast format, we kind of get to explore it a little bit at a time.
And I think that one thing that I would say about the show is the reason we called it divination with a queer twist rather than divination with a gay twist is because the word queer or being queer doesn't really have to do with specifically sexual orientation or sexual preference so much as, you know, like the definition of the word means things like strange or odd from a conventional standpoint, something that is unusually different, or in some ways you might just say outside of the norm. And so I think part of what our goal is with this new show is to look at things using the tarot and other divination tools from an unconventional viewpoint and perspective, and allow for the fact that everyone has something queer about them, and it's how to embrace that, live that, accept that, and be that, and using tarot, etc., to find ways to more fully do that. So it's certainly not just about a particular sexual orientation, as it is a more encompassing, just something different or a slightly different perspective on how we view life and how we live life.
Yes, I actually rather enjoy that how many different groups or different people, individual people, have embraced the word queer. I think when I first encountered it, it meant specifically, or it was usually intended to mean, gay. But so many people are embracing it, the sort of otheredness of a queer identity, of a sort of slightly outside identity. And I think divination is a wonderful tool for anyone who is sort of coloring outside of the lines, out of the prescribed path in life. And when you sort of have to create your own destiny, because there's not really a blueprint, because for whatever reason you're considered not like the other kids, divination is an amazing tool for that kind of discovery and growth and thriving.
And I think that if we can give a little sneak peek of what's coming up on the episode Tuesday, then it may also help people understand a little bit of how we're approaching it from that slightly unconventional standpoint. One of the things that we'll be doing is, because this is the time of year for the winter solstice and Yule, and one of the things that's often associated with this time of year is the myth of the Holly King and the Oak King. And so can you maybe say how we're going to take a little bit of put our own queer twist on that?
Yes,
myth?
It's queer twist. Well, the Holly King and the Oak King is a very heteronormative myth that kind of comes from the Robert Graves school of new and neo-pagan mythology, and it's the idea of the two competing males vying for supremacy. But I was inspired by a witchcraft teacher of mine, Storm Fairywolf, had a different take on that myth, that it didn't have to be about polarity and power over and destruction, that the two figures, the Holly King and the Oak King, could find harmony with each other. And of course, anytime there's any sort of spiritual truth, I feel like there's a tarot spread somewhere in there to explore that. So Heisi and I put our heads together and created a new spread based on the myth of the Holly King and the Oak King that can help lead you to find a way to find harmony where there is conflict between either yourself and another individual or between institutions. So you'll have to tune in, though, to find out what that spread is all about.
And we'll be doing that in the future as well, by putting the queer twist on things, by just turning it, twisting it, or tweaking it ever so slightly to look at it from a slightly different way. So, for example, this, instead of two kings that are at rivals of each other, we look at them as, well, what if they're actually lovers?
Yes.
Our featured guest on our upcoming episode Tuesday is recording artist Casey Stratton. And, you know, the thing that kind of puts the queer twist on having him as our guest, one thing that prompted it is that he just released a new album with, it's an EP, six tracks based on six tarot cards that he pulled, each track being for one of those tarot cards. And part of the queer twist is that he was signed to a major recording label, Sony Classical, and then decided to leave the major label and form his own label, and has been releasing his music independently for 7 or 8 years now. And, you know, to me, that's the queer twist, because that's the unconventional route. Most people think, oh, you try to get signed to a major label and then you do everything you can to stay on the major label. He took a different route, which was, yes, he got signed to the major label, but then realized he wanted to be more independent and left the major label. And that, to me, is the queer twist, is it's taking a more individual approach or path rather than the conformity of what society or other people would say would be the best way or the normal way to do things.
And, of course, the divination connection is that his latest album is based on a series of tarot cards that he used to inspire each of the six tracks. No, I believe.
Right. Yes. And one thing that we're going to do is we're going to look at those six cards while we're talking to him, and we're actually going to use them to do a reading and see what they have to say as to why they may have come up the way that they did for the album.
Mm-hmm.
And then another segment, which will be an ongoing segment that we're going to be doing, is called Living the Queer Life.
Mm-hmm.
And in that, we're going to be using tarot and other tools to help people figure out how to more spiritually and fulfillingly live their life in a singular, individual, authentic way.
Mm-hmm. And
go ahead.
I was just going to say, maybe we'll pull different cards and see what lessons we can learn about sort of that eternal quest.
And it's really to use whatever tools we have at our disposal to encourage and empower people to be more queer, to be more individual, and to trust being themselves, even if it seems odd or strange or out of the norm, rather than feeling as if there's something odd or strange about themselves and to somehow look at that negatively.
And I feel like the divination community is a wonderful, very embracing community for all sorts of characters. So I think that it's one of the most open and embracing, to use that word again, communities I've ever encountered. So I think it's a wonderful place to do this work.
And we're forward to having many of those colorful and unusual characters, say, that are part of the divination world as well as the broader spiritual spectrum on our show, to hear more from them about what makes them queer and how they embrace that and how they live that on a day-to-day level.
And I think this show will be of interest to, if you're wondering, well, I don't identify as queer, maybe I don't need to listen to this show. I think there will be something for anyone interested in exploratory spirituality or divination. I think there'll be something for you. And if listening to the show turns you queer, that wasn't our intention, but you're welcome anyway.
That's right. And I think it may also, you know, I think listening to the show may also help people realize we all have something queer about ourselves. And, you know, if you ever just look and see when someone has said, oh, that's interesting, or oh, that's unusual, or oh, I've never heard of that before, response to something that you've said that you do or that you like or that you are, that's that queerness that each of us have. You know, not a lot of people like to quilt. So if someone says they're really into quilting and they go every week to a quilting circle, well, that may be the queer aspect of them, because that's kind of out of the norm, especially today. I mean, maybe 100 years ago that wouldn't have been so out of the norm, but today that's something that's a bit unusual. And so I think that our hope with this show is to help people not only see that everyone has something queer about them, but also how to embrace that and to really live that fully, using tarot and other tools to look at things, to explore those things, and to really find a way to embrace them and let them be a celebrated part of ourselves rather than a part that makes us feel embarrassed or ashamed.
Yeah, and that moment you just described where when someone finds out something about you that is unusual and they make that statement, whether they realize what they're doing or not, like, oh, that's weird, that's unusual, like that presents an opportunity to either sort of shrink into yourself and apologize and, you know, try and shy away from, you know, your core truth, or kind of embrace it and have a teaching moment and a growing moment, and to more fully love your sort of queer facet that was just revealed, and, you know, create a sense of pride around that. Just in that moment. So we'll be looking for that.
And we'll challenge people whenever somebody says something like that to them. Oh, that's odd. That's weird. That's strange to them. Then we want to help encourage people to simply respond by saying, and you're welcome.
There we go. Yes. That ends the lesson.
That's right. Because that queer aspect has suddenly made that other person's life a little more interesting and colorful just by the fact they've been exposed to it.
Yes. So expose yourself, dear listeners, as often as possible.
Yeah. I'm not going to say that's our main goal, but if that's an indirect result of our show, that people are willing to expose themselves more to the people that they cross on the street, well, more power to them.
Yes. Well done. Well done, you.
Excellent. So just to let people know, the Amethyst Oracle debuts on Tuesday, December 11th at 8 p.m. Pacific. And it will be right here under the Firefly Willows Live channel. So you can find it at blogtalkradio.com/Firefly Willows Live. And it will also be available in the archives after the show airs. So you can listen to it anytime after Tuesday. It'll also be available to download as a podcast on iTunes. Just look up Firefly Willows Live and it'll be there along with the other shows. And then the Amethyst Historical will be airing every second Tuesday of each month at 8 p.m. Pacific Live, and then available afterwards both in the archives on Blog Talk as well as on iTunes as a podcast. So thanks, Charlie, for joining me here today to give a little sneak peek of that. And we will look forward to being with you on Tuesday and hopefully being with some of the other people that are listening and letting them start to explore and delve into what the Amethyst Oracle has to say to them about their own personal queerness.
Whether they like it or not. Wonderful.
And just to reassure people, on our show, The Amethyst Historical, we'll have sound effects at the ready. We won't be doing dun da 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 ourselves.
No,
we'll have
yes.
a far more library of things.
Yeah.
So, any closing remarks you would like to offer?
Well, you know, let's see. I just pulled a card to... Oh, God, it's so interesting. I'm using for this the Gay Tarot by Lee Burstyn. I thought it was appropriate. And I sort of just pulled a card to... see what other information I could say about that. And I got 15, which in most decks is the devil, but in this deck is titled Self-Hatred. And it shows a young man looking at a picture of a nuclear family, and you get the impression that he feels very outside of that experience. So I think I'm taking that as a message that is one aspect of the show, or one goal of the show, will be lessening that feeling of self-hatred, of self-doubt that can be a source of bondage for anyone, but I guess for our listeners.
That really is a card, you know, as the devil card, that really is the card of the shadow side. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I think that's perfectly appropriate for what we're going to be doing on the show, which is delving into what most people would consider the shadow side, which are often the sides of themselves or other people that they feel embarrassed, ashamed about, like you said, the self-hatred part. But we're going to be shining a light on those and helping those move from what's called the dark shadow to the golden shadow, to start seeing what's the potential of allowing those things to be shown and fully illuminated in the world rather than hidden away.
Mm, yes. Or it could also just mean that we're the devil.
Well, you know.
You know.
We have our devilish side.
I'm just allowing for that possibility as well.
You know, one phrase I think of when I see the devil card is take a walk on the wild side. And it is very much a card about liberation and freedom, because we're tossing off the chains of conditioning and what we've been told we're supposed to do or be, or how we should be. And hopefully with our show, we're going to help people feel more empowered and take the power back for themselves, to not feel so bound by needing to conform to what others say they should be, versus people being willing to be themselves and free themselves and liberate what it is and who they are, no matter how odd or bizarre it may seem, freeing and liberating that for the world to see, because ultimately that will then probably touch, inspire, or connect them to others, rather than be something that needs to be a source of shame or embarrassment.
Cool.
So join us on Tuesday for a devilish good time. Take a walk on the wild side with Charlie and High C, and hopefully we will enjoy your company on Tuesday, December 11th at 8 p.m. Pacific for the Amethyst Oracle, right here on Blog Talk Radio. So I will see you on Tuesday, Charlie.
Absolutely.
And thank you to everyone for listening today. I hope that you enjoyed the show. We look forward to having you here not only every Sunday, but now as we start having new shows Tuesday, as well as other nights as we move into 2013. And if you want to listen to a previous show or just enjoy this show once again, you can always find it in the archives on Blog Talk Radio or as a podcast on iTunes. Just look for Firefly Willows Live and it'll come right up. So thank you for listening, and join us next week when our host will be John Carosella for his show Convergence. And until then, we will look forward to an amazing week, an amazing month, and an amazing life. So thanks, and see you next time.
Thank you for joining us on today's episode of Revolution. We hope you enjoyed the show. Join us next week for Convergence with John Carosella. John talks with Heather Ash Amara,
one of Don Miguel Ruiz's earliest students and author of The Toltec Path of Transformation. Heather Ash shares wisdom on remaking the self gained from Toltec and European shamanic traditions. With the approaching winter solstice, John also shares insights into the Nordic rune Isa, which represents the stillness of ice in winter. He'll also reflect on what he's learned about the healing power of sleep. Be sure to listen in to our occasional segment, Fire and Water. John and Deb are sure to have different perspectives. And for our roundtable next week, John hosts a discussion on stillness. Tune in for that and more next week on Convergence. This is Deb Caracella. Please join us next Sunday morning at 10:30 a.m. Pacific Time on Firefly Willows LIVE Presents Blog Talk Radio.